traditional taxis, and Uber and Lyft. Just ahead on the show, we've got a look at the road ahead for those rides for hire here in Jacksonville. Good Thursday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and watch the show now, too. Video on demand with our partner, TVJax.com. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on Uber and Lyft. What are your questions? As we speak with Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Schellenberg, get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, a look inside the St. Augustine Distillery, plus local filmmaker Dwight Cenac. Find out why he was at the Cannes Film Festival this spring. All of that ahead. But first this hour, we've got a closer look at where things stand when it comes to regulating ride-for-hire companies in Jacksonville, such as Uber and Lyft. For some time now, there's been a back and forth over how and whether to regulate these popular companies, which have disrupted the traditional taxi cab model, not just here in North Florida, but around the country and even the world. Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Schellenberg has chaired the council's Vehicles for Hire Committee, and he joins us now in studio. Councilman, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Great to see you. And here is our question to callers. What are your thoughts and comments and questions about the struggle to regulate companies for hire, rides for hire, like Uber and Lyft here in Jacksonville? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/First Coast Connect. Email, tweet the show, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page. So the Jacksonville City Council Vehicles for Hire Special Committee has been meeting on this for some time, having discussions about background checks and vehicle inspections. Councilman Schellenberg, can you bring us up to date? Where do things stand on this right now?
We're working through the process, but I think it's important to know what the current regulations are for the taxis and how it came about. And it came about 30 years ago because there was a severe problem with taxis and regulating. The current regulations are you do a background check. There's no fingerprinting, but the regulation says every 5 years. Now, interesting enough, the taxi industry has decided that it's probably better to do it every year, so they've gone beyond what the city regulations are. So in that regard, I think that where we're going is a good place, and right now the transportation network companies are doing it every year. And in their program, in their business, they're doing this background check every year. Mm-hmm. In regard to vehicle inspections, that does happen. But what we found out in the committee is that it's really very subjective. They go over there, they do a cursory view of the vehicle, make sure that it has tires, etc. There really isn't any public safety that's really going on in the vehicle for hires. What I have suggested and where we're moving forward is that anybody that does business with the city of Jacksonville does have a background check every year. And in that regard, there's some people that want the city to do it. I believe that corporations are very responsible because it's in their best interest to do it. So that's a little bit of the division right there. Mm. And vehicle inspections, yes, the requirement is you have to go to the city's location. I believe that any ASE certified mechanic can do it. And quite frankly, the city, when they do the inspection, they don't have an ASE person do it. They have someone that is required to do certain things. So those are the two items. And I think the third one is, I've gone blank right now, but the third one is insurance.
Insurance, yeah, sure.
In the state, taxis have to have a blanket coverage all the time. And in the committee, it was discussed, and through our risk management, they said, why is the taxis always has to have this high level of insurance? And basically, when they're not on call, they should basically have the lower interest insurance rate, and basically the same thing happens with the Uber and Lyft people.
What about the argument that's been posed that it's not a level playing field when taxis are still bound by the traditional medallion system? They have to have a medallion to operate. They have, in the past, faced a higher level of regulation. What about that argument that the taxi cab companies are making?
Well, as I think I just mentioned, the actual regulations from the city are mm-hmm. not necessarily enforceable, but they're not very objective. Okay, so getting the medallion is $100. They meet certain requirements, and I said that the actual regulation is 5 years for a background check and vehicle inspection. It's not done by an ASC person. So I believe that a medallion is just a way for the city to get some money. I don't believe that this is the way that we should be going. And most
should we throw out the medallion system?
Well, quite frankly, that's where I would like to go. And I think, quite frankly, there's no reason why we do actually have it. I think if you do this certain things, and it behooves most companies, taxis and transportation network companies, to make sure that they hire good people to represent them on a daily basis.
We'll go to your calls for Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Schellenberg in a moment. He chairs the Vehicles for Hire Committee looking at regulating ride hire companies like the taxi cab firms and Uber and Lyft. It's 549-2937 to join us. We recently hosted your colleague on this program, Councilman John Cressenbeny. He has floated the idea of a referendum on Uber and Lyft, a voter referendum. What do you think about that?
This is interesting because, you know, I think he pulls out that referendum that was in Austin.
Mm-hmm. And because of that referendum, Uber and Lyft are no longer on the roads in Austin, Texas.
Well, there's two things I think that we should bring to the forefront. One is that the University of Texas is right in the middle of the Austin city limits, and most college students would not register to vote in that area. They are registered to vote on their home, where they come from. So if you were to allow them to vote, that vote would be the opposite, in my opinion, because it's the millennials that understand how important it is to get on the world. The world is their iPhone, to call up and be responsible and make sure that if they've had a drink or two, they get home safely. And quite frankly, there's generic studies that basically because they're doing this, you have less traffic accidents and less vehicle fatalities on the road.
Lots of calls for Councilman Matt Schellenberg on Uber and Lyft. We'll go to the phones in just a moment at 549-2937. Let me ask you this as a follow-up. Since I challenged Mr. Cressenbeny on this, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you the same type of question. There's a perception that Councilman Cressenbeny is partial to the taxi cab companies. There's also a perception, or at least it's been raised by these firms, that you are biased perhaps in favor of the more modern Uber and Lyft app-based companies. What do you say to those who feel you're not impartial in this debate?
That's interesting because 3 or 4 years ago, my nephews and nieces, all those young people, in fact, people my age, I do not drink, but they would come to me and say, I love Uber and Lyft. And until I went to California recently, I had never used it. I only had anecdotal evidence that they were great. And you know what? My experience was great because people don't understand the dynamics of where people are going. The young people, and even my age, I'm 60-something, are going to the app to getting all the information they need. All the taxis have to do is have an app to make it easy for people to contact them.
And you think that's what they should do to adapt to the changing landscape of this business model?
I think that for 30 years they've had a monopoly, and I think that this is, as you indicated in your opening, that there's a viable option right now, and people are using it. And in my understanding, worldwide understanding, they have over 3 million trips that they do a day, every 24 hours, and that's an enormous. It's because the convenience of just calling up wherever they are, going to a Lyft or Uber app and saying, wow, I can get somebody there and out of here as quickly as possible.
And what are your calls and questions for the councilman about the debate over regulating Uber and Lyft here in North Florida? What are your thoughts about this? 549-2937. Let's begin with Isaac on the north side. Isaac, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing great, thanks.
Listen, I am a Uber driver. I'll tell you that up front. And the basic point that I want to make, as far as the medallions are concerned, the cab companies, the actual cab company, not the driver in the cab, the only business that they're in is getting that medallion and then renting out the car to an independent driver. They don't care about giving people rides. They don't care about transportation. They don't care of anything. All they want to do is have the medallion so they can rent a car. Where, as far as Uber is concerned, myself as an independent driver, when I log in, I am giving people a ride. That's my only concern, is to get the client from point A to point B. I did go through a background check. When I signed in, they asked me to submit all my information, insurance, driver's license, car registration, and then a few days later, I got a third party company, said that your background is cleared, you're ready to drive, and they have very strict vehicle requirements. It doesn't get inspected, but it has to be in good working condition, because if it's not, then the client, the passenger, can report me to Uber that's driving an unsafe vehicle, and Uber will contact me if they take your vehicle off the road.
Mm-hmm.
Or,
okay,
you know, tell me that I'm not allowed to drive anymore. So and then the other thing that nobody mentions, right now in Jacksonville, cab fares are three times as much when it's compared to Uber. Uber is at 75 cents a mile. Cab companies charge 35 cents for every tenth of a mile. So equaling to $3.50 per mile, where Uber is transporting for at 75 cents a mile.
Okay, Isaac.
There's very big difference.
All right. Councilman Schellenberg.
He brings up a very good point. I think if you've never used Uber or Lyft, you don't understand the dynamics. Now, he mentioned all the background checks that we talked about. But not only that, is the person that requests the request for a driver for Uber or Lyft, you actually have his face, a picture of him, as well as the license and the car. So even if he comes and you feel uncomfortable, you don't have to get in the car. You just walk away. The other thing is that he mentioned was both the driver and the occupant grade each other. And if you get too many bad grades on a driver, we can't be an Uber driver or Lyft driver. And conversely, if you're a rude passenger, you won't be able to use their system.
Jack is in St. Augustine. Hi, Jack. What are your thoughts? Good morning.
Yes, I'm actually driven for Uber, and it was a good experience. But on the flip side, my experience with cab companies, the service that rideshare companies provide is so much better because of the app, because you can track where the driver is on their way to pick you up. And my experience with cab companies is if you call and ask for a ride, they say they'll be there in 10 minutes. And inevitably, or every time it's been 20, 30 minutes, you call them back, and they say, oh, we're right around the corner. It's another 10 minutes. It's just a better service with the rideshare for the customer when you're actually trying to get somewhere in a timely manner.
Okay, thanks, Jack. And let me ask you as a follow-up. When Councilman Crescenbeny was here, he expressed a lot of concerns when it comes to the safety of Uber drivers. You don't share that view?
He brings out two instances. And by the way, they all pass the background checks, okay? There's no question. The problem with background checks is it's not current. You do a background check yet today, and in a week or two, someone can do something bad. Nothing in the system will prevent bad people to get in the system, but they are automatically, once it happens, they're dismissed. That's like any business. You hire people, you do the background check, but they do it every year. The city's requirement is only every 5 years. So the taxis have issues. They all have people, businesses have issues with their employees periodically. The tragedy of some of these things always happen after they do the background checks, and they took care of it because they don't want the reputation they want a great reputation for a great experience just to go from one point to another as quickly as possible.
549-2937. Richard on the west side. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Good morning. Yeah, I'd like to know if the councilman feels the same way about unregulated lodging, like Airbnb, as he feels about unregulated transportation. If, you know, Airbnb, like Airbnb lodging is not inspected and it's not subject to the county's bed tax, so the taxpayers are losing. Clients have little recourse if there are any problems. And, you know, a relative of mine was shot outside an Airbnb in Murray Hill. It was advertised as perfectly safe, and the so-called host refused to refund their rent that they paid in advance. What is the city doing about this? And are you perfectly content with people renting out their space and buying houses and destroying neighborhoods with Airbnb?
Okay, what about that?
Well, again, I'm a great listener and a great looking at where we are and where we're going. And this Airbnb is similar to transportation network companies. So if this person had a bad experience, do you think that lodging will ever be able to go back and do this again? The answer is absolutely not. I talk to lots of people that have used Airbnb. I have never used it, but their experience is overwhelmingly successful. Have they been in places that have not been as nice? The answer is, of course. But they grade them both ways, to both the person that is sleeping there, as well as the person that's leasing it. And it's amazing. This is a different world we live in, and I don't think you can regulate these kind of things. I think if they're coming to Jacksonville, and maybe they should be paying a bed tax, but they're spending money here. And as long as they're coming here, I think it's great. And
it speaks to the larger issue. We're living through a time when digital technology is disrupting just about every industry. Mm-hmm. People interact with it in a real concrete way when they try to hail either a cab or an app-based ride. But this is wildly disruptive technology that is forcing business models to adapt or stop operating. What do you think about that?
Well, I think it goes back to fairness. There's nothing unfair about what transportation networks companies are doing or Airbnb. They are using the digital world to be more efficient and to get people from A to B quicker than any place else. Or it gives the people an option to go into an older neighborhood, Murray Hill, Avondale, to experience that. Maybe they don't want to go to a bed and breakfast place or a hotel. If they have a bad experience, they will never do it again. And by the way, they won't go to that location, but they'll have a bad experience with Airbnb and they might not use it anymore. Fairness is the industry is changing, and all that taxis have to do is get in the digital world and to make it.
Have you said that to the cab companies yourself? And what was the response?
Well, they're working on it. Well, that's great. But I suggested not only they need an app locally, but they need a taxi worldwide network so all the people can use it on the same thing. By the way, there's many people, the taxis are having a terrible time in San Francisco and many other places because the world has changed dramatically in that grade.
All right, let's go to a few more calls for Councilman Matt Schellenberg. He chairs the City Council's Vehicles for Hire Special Committee. When we look at this ongoing issue about regulating Uber and Lyft, few comments on our Facebook page. John writes, if we want to attract millennials to the city, we need to be open to the sharing economy, and that includes groups like Uber and Lyft. Robert writes, I feel safe using Uber. It's efficient, and I know what I'll be charged, and they show up on time. Let's go to Chris in Atlantic Beach. He's on the line. Hi, Chris. Good morning.
Hi. First of all, I thank you for bringing this issue up and hosting it on your radio show. It's terrific, and it's very timely. I also called in when you had Representative Chris Danby on the show. And as I indicated, I sympathize with the cab companies because they have regulations and burdens that put them at a competitive disadvantage. But my personal experience with Uber is that it is just so much better than the old taxi cab route. I just cannot see taxi cabs as they currently exist continuing in the digital world. I don't know if the answer is to create a special place for cabs so that they have exclusive rights to cover certain areas and hours that Uber does not want to cover or is unwilling to cover, or if the cabs need to become Ubers. I don't know. But I agree with your current guest. Uber and Lyft are so vastly superior that it makes no sense to stay in the dark ages.
Okay, thanks, Chris. What about his comments and also his perception that the cab companies, even if they're not providing as good of an experience, they are at a competitive disadvantage, that they're held to a different regulatory standard? And is it incumbent upon you to fix that for them?
Well, what's great about it is that we are, because we're looking at what is the regulation now. And And right now, vehicles inspections, really, we weren't really, I mean, they did, but there wasn't anything to it. They just looked around, and basically it was surface-oriented. So they had to get a vehicle inspected every 120 days. We turned to them, and I said to them, why is that possible? It behooves you to have a vehicle in working order, in perfect condition, making the experiences great. So we made it from 120 days to, we're working on it to a year. They agreed to it because it's in their best interest. So, and we also suggested that they have different insurance. When the cap's not on thing, they should have lower insurance. And then when they have somebody on in the vehicle, then the insurance changes, much like the transportation network companies.
Robert in St. Augustine. Hi, Robert. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hi. Oh, hi. Thanks for having this subject on. Hey, right off the bat, I am I'm a taxi driver. I have Uber on my phone. I have Lyft. I drive with them sometimes. I also have a commercial driver's license, which I don't think most taxi drivers or Uber drivers also have. So from this viewpoint, I look at it like this. Any business that's in the business of transporting human beings for profit should be regulated. We should be protecting people. Taxi regulations aren't being done correctly. Uber and Lyft, these are just taxi dispatch companies. They're hiding behind an app to say that they're just a technology provider, but they've made billions of dollars off of the drivers that drive for them, and the drivers are really putting the cost because the money that Uber pays to its drivers, I haven't heard this expressed yet, is so small that actually in areas like Jacksonville and St. Augustine, you're working for less than minimum wage if you're relying upon Uber. So their regulations across the board need to be standardized, I think, so that everybody can be protected, including the workers, the drivers, because quite frankly, I don't see how when you take the cost of your vehicle and maintaining or replacing that vehicle, how you could possibly survive on what Uber and Lyft pay out to the drivers. And then from the taxi standpoint, well, the taxis have become quite complacent. There are taxi apps. I use a few of those, too. There are apps that you can hail a taxi with. It's just not consolidated. It's not very widespread. It's usually only available locally, although the companies are actually nationwide.
All right.
And that's all I got to say.
Thanks, Robert. All right. Thank you for that.
Yeah, this is an interesting perspective. If people are doing this and barely making minimum wage, they'll move on. They will not do it. Obviously, there are people in the transportation network that are doing better than minimum wage. But why would you do it unless you made money? And and what's amazing to me is the car manufacturers are getting this business, as well as enterprise. They're providing better leases or availability of newer cars so people can get into Uber and Lyft and their transportation network companies and to have a cleaner, a newer vehicle. It's just moving so fast. It is amazing to me. And I believe this down the road, because cars are getting fairly expensive, insurance on cars are getting fairly expensive, people might be thinking, why should I have a car when I have such easy access to go from A to B? Mm. And when you look at other companies like Apple spending $1 billion to do this in China, as well as a recent investment in Uber of $3.5 billion, the dynamics of the industry is changing so fast.
Brian in the Intercoastal West area. Hey, Brian, what are your thoughts?
A couple things. I mean, I love it when people sit there and they're so concerned about the poor driver who's not making any money and all this kind of stuff. Look, it's a competitive world. If the driver is out there and he feels he can make a living or make some money doing X, he'll do it. The second thing is I have access to some of the top 5% of the people in this city. And they go all over the country. And you know what they're using? Uber. Okay? So my point is that, you know, if Jacksonville wants to be, you know, like a big city, it needs to incorporate the technology that the other cities are using. And I am sorry that, you know, it's just like anything else. It's like the buggy whip. You know, time has changed, and we've all agreed on the station, time has changed. But the bottom line is that the taxi companies are not providing a better service. And, you know, it behooves them to change their model and come into the real world and give us a better product. So, you know, I just think what I find interesting is that if you talk to the people, the movers and shakers in this city, they're using Uber. Okay. All over the country. All over the world.
Thank you. And here are a few emails. Here's one from Amy. Both Uber and Lyft have high auto insurance coverages in addition to coverage protecting passengers. Lyft does a vehicle inspection and background check. And here's another email from a listener pointing out that in today's money section of the Florida Times Union, it's being reported that Saudi Arabia just invested $3.5 billion into Uber. So as Uber takes over the world, let's look at the road ahead in Jacksonville. Where does the Vehicle for Hire Committee go from here, Councilman?
Wow. Hopefully we'll get something out of the committee in the next week or two before the end of the cycle with the new leadership change. And I think this is the same problem. You said we've been working on a long time, but we've had suspensions because we were hoping that the Tallahassee would take care of it. I think right now there's political pressure not to do anything. But interesting enough, the citizens are requiring. It's just not the business people. It's people that have doctor's appointments that need to be there on time. I know doctor's offices that are using it because they have to meet. They have to be there on time. The world is changing faster than that we can get something done. And all I want to do is, I don't want to level the playing field. That's not really. They have every opportunity to have an app so people can go to. And as I repeat, it's not just a local app. It's got to be in the taxi. They should all get together and get an app to compete against Uber. That $3.5 billion that Saudi Arabia did valued Uber at $65 billion, which is twice what the value of General Motors is. So it gives you perspective. Not that people are willing to do it. I'm just saying that the world is changing and people are recognizing it. And to a certain extent, I recognize it because I tried it. I always heard anecdotally that it's great. My nieces and my nephews, they're all young people, and women love it especially because they have the picture of the man or the woman driving and the car and the license plate. And you know what they do after that? They take that and they forward it to their friends. So if anything ever happens, they know exactly where they were, who picked them up, and that's how they take care of Uber. Because it behooves those transportation network companies to make sure that who they have representing them are doing a great job.
We'll continue to follow it. In the meantime, thanks for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Schellenberg chairs the council's Vehicles for Hire Special Committee. And in a moment, we're going to continue a discussion of regulatory battles, but this involves a different industry, Florida's craft distillery business. Up next, spotlighting the St. Augustine Distillery. Back in a moment.
Legal and political segments on First Coast Connect, brought to you by Farrah and Farrah. Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America is a multi-platform public media initiative that provides a deeper understanding of the impact of poverty on American society. Tune in to the PBS NewsHour weeknights at 7 on WJCT-TV for compelling stories of individuals and organizations addressing such issues. And log on to chasingthedreamproject.org. Funding for this initiative is provided by the JPB Foundation and Ford Foundation. Local funding provided by Wells Fargo.
Among the things that have changed the most in this economy is the very nature of what it means to have a job. You've heard the phrase, the gig economy.
People are going to get taken advantage of. And there is no question in my mind that some drivers have been taken advantage of.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Employment in America on 18 Wheels, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT's Great Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at 75% off at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. Bid now. The auction continues through June 13th at 8 p.m. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
Welcome back. Well, the St. Augustine Distillery has seen success since it opened in the city's restored historic ice plant a few years ago. But while this craft distillery is on the cutting edge of what consumers are asking for and it's gained a loyal following, the owners have also had to become lobbyists of sorts, pressing the state of Florida to change the way it regulates liquor sales and distribution. Michael Diaz is CFO and co-founder of the St. Augustine Distillery, and he's here to fill us in. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
In the first segment of the show, we talked about how Uber has disrupted transportation and ride-for-hire companies. You guys have sort of disrupted the existing business model for liquor in the state of Florida, I think, in a way. Is that fair to say?
I think it's fair to say, and I think it's fair to say what we're really getting to is almost a return to the past. If you look back prior to Prohibition, local distilleries existed almost everywhere, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of local product available, and it was only post-Prohibition that a lot of these restrictions were put in place. And, you know, after Prohibition, there was only four large liquor companies in the whole country.
Wow. So it's been a long time coming, these changes that you're advocating for legislatively. What are you up against? What are some of the hurdles in terms of turning this distillery into an ongoing, profitable concern?
Really, our biggest challenge is there's a limit on, Florida has a three-tier system in place where you can either manufacture liquor, distribute liquor, or retail liquor, but you can't do any two. And so when we started the business, we could manufacture our liquor and we could have tours, and we do have very successful tours. We get about 140,000 people a year through there. But when we started, we could tour, but we couldn't sell anything to the consumer. We had to just direct them to a retailer. We had the law changed in 2013 with the help of Doc Renouart and John Thrasher so that we could sell two bottles per person per year. Very restrictive. And
very much so, yeah. You can only buy two. And do your customers complain when they get that explained to them?
Absolutely.
They don't like that.
They're shocked. You know, it's not a law that is anybody's really aware of until they're put in that situation.
So you had John Thrasher and Doc Renouart, your local legislators, revise the law. But what would be your ideal situation in terms of running a business where people could tour this historic ice plant, see how you make the distilled artisanal liquor, but then they want to take a few bottles home? What change are you seeking from Tallahassee right now?
Our preferred answer would be to treat us just like you do a brewery or a winery. Today, if you go into a local brewery, you can buy drinks by the glass. You can buy unlimited quantities. And that's what we would like to see.
And other states have moved ahead of Florida in this regard.
Many,
right?
Many states.
Yeah.
For example, one example which always shocks everybody is New York. Is typically thought of as a very restrictive state. But in the state of New York, if you make liquor with New York agricultural products in it, and we're very proud to make our liquor with Florida agricultural products, the state of New York allows their craft distilleries to sell unlimited. It allows them to self-distribute. It allows them to serve drinks by the glass. It allows them to have a separate retail store. And as a result, there's over 100 craft distilleries in the state of New York versus about 25 in Florida today.
Let's go to Lee in Mandarin. The number to join us is, we've lost that call, but the number to join us is 549-2937. So you see this as the next wave. We've seen, craft beer just take off like wildfire all over the country. Wineries are extremely popular. And now distilleries are sort of the next vanguard into this. And there really aren't a lot of other distilleries like yours in Northeast Florida that I know of.
No, that's correct. There's more distilleries opening up, but most of them quite often are either remote or difficult to access areas. And one of our tenants is we want to educate, entertain, and inspire at our distillery. We designed it around having visitors in because we think consumer trial is very, very important. But you're spot on with the increase in craft distilleries across the country. There's a craft cocktail movement. And just like you saw with wineries in the 70s, just like you saw with craft breweries in the late 90s, early 2000s, you're seeing the same thing nationally with distilleries, and it gives consumers a choice. It actually gives retailers and distributors something new to sell. So we think it's an economic rising tide for everybody.
Why do you think it's change has been so slow to come in Florida?
Probably two reasons. The first is just the bureaucratic difficulty of getting anything through a system. There's just a very, very changing legislation's a challenge. Mm-hmm. And secondly, there's a large bureaucracy and a large contingent of retailers and distributors that are very content with the status quo. Mm-hmm. We believe that what's good for craft distilleries is great for retailers and great for distributors because we're getting people to try something different. We're getting people to purchase things they may not otherwise purchase. And so mm-hmm. I think people are coming around to that point of view.
And as you continue to make that case, you're getting lots of visitors to the St. Augustine Distillery. It is in the old historic ice plant, which has a fascinating background of its own.
That's correct. Yeah. It was actually the first ice plant built in Florida. Florida Power and Light had power, so of course they built ice. The ice plant we're in was built starting in 1906, ended in 1926, and provided all the ice, about 120 tons of ice a day. And ice was the lifeblood of St. Augustine for local consumption. Everybody had an ice box to ship the produce on rail, to ship the seafood on rail, all required ice. And so FP&L built about a dozen of these ice plants around the state. They're all gone now except for one, I believe, in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And we've restored that to its original really splendor. We share that facility with a separate company, which is a bar and restaurant upstairs called the Ice Plant. And we're really excited to have visitors through there.
And you are doing artisanal spirits, all Florida-based. It's vodka, gin, and bourbon is coming in the fall. Is that right?
We do. We make vodka, gin,
rum and bourbon.
And bourbon to come out in the fall. And we use our ethos is to make as spectacular spirit. We want to make excellent spirits with as local ingredients as possible. So something like our vodka and our gin are based on a cane-neutral spirit from sugarcane. Our rum is made with regional molasses and cane syrup from Florida and South Georgia. So we go outside Florida when we can and need to get stuff. Our bourbon is made with Florida corn, Florida wheat, and we actually have to get the barley outside of Florida because nobody grows barley in Florida.
Huh.
Yeah, and we felt like you needed barley in the bourbon to make the recipe we wanted to make. So our mission is to make it excellent first and then as local as possible.
Well, keep us posted on the changes within this industry, and thanks for shining the spotlight on it.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Michael Diaz is CFO and co-founder of the St. Augustine Distillery. And we're back in a moment.
WJCT and Baptist Health invite you to Girls Day Out, Saturday, September 17th at the Hyatt Hotel. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, great speakers, including celebrity chef My Fam, and Good Morning America host and breast cancer survivor Amy Robach. Tickets are $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
There's a line. Draw it in the sand, put it in water, mark it in blood. But once you cross it, there is no going back. On the next Snap Judgment, Unforgiven. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT. Ahead of a high-level meeting between the U.S. and China, we'll hear from a top U.S. diplomat on the complicated issues facing the two nations.
What the Chinese have been doing in the South China Sea, it's alarmed the neighbors, and the net effect has been to drive Southeast Asian countries into America's arms.
That's next time on All Things Considered from NPR News. Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross.
Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. A local company with a global presence in the film industry represented Jacksonville recently at the Cannes Film Festival. Dwight Sinek is director of operations at Indio. They're based here in town, but they're a worldwide online film market serving distributors, sales agents, producers, studios, and everyone in between. Dwight was a guest speaker at Cannes at a panel on film financing and distribution, and he joins us now. Good to see you.
Oh, great. Thank you for having me.
So you went all the way to Cannes. How exciting is that?
It's the French Riviera.
Yeah.
You cannot complain. It leaves you speechless.
Was it your first time?
No, that's our fourth consecutive visit to France.
And so how are you getting on these panels at Cannes? Because I would think that's a fairly high bar. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I was actually kind of blown away when they came and approached me about it. We've been pretty active in the industry.
Yeah.
So the people who in our industry know who we are, know what we're about. And, so they invited me and I went.
And off you went and you spoke about film financing and distribution. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah, so I personally spoke more about distribution. We had a film financier on the panel. It was a conference panel of three of us. And it was mainly my perspective was in educating filmmakers on if they want to get distribution, what are the first steps? And that usually, like what most filmmakers don't realize is that's actually like the first thing you should think about before you make a movie. And so I spoke a lot about virtual reality and where we're going in the virtual reality industry.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And so that was my...
Where are we going?
I like to put it this way, like this is where I see in the very near future is that this is my bold claim and I could be completely wrong, but I don't think I am. I think as movie theaters are forced to rethink their business model to keep up with where the industry evolves, we're going to start seeing theater screens that are pretty much dedicated entirely to virtual reality. So you'll have these 4D chairs with these built-in VR headsets. And people will pay anywhere from $10 to $15 for a 15-minute ride.
Wow.
And that's where I see everything going.
So the movie will envelop you all together.
That's correct.
You'll be wrapped in a movie.
You'll be riding that wave of a film, yeah.
That is so exciting. How soon do you think that's coming?
Well, actually, so like 3 years ago, I was approached by a group of people who had an idea for this kind of concept. And I was like, oh, we need to make movies like this. And then last year at Cannes, at this pavilion that shows like technological advancements, they had actually the little virtual reality goggles. And that's when I knew that this was right around the corner. This year at every major film festival in the country, there's these huge workshops and panels about virtual reality. Virtual reality is pretty much dominating these markets and these festivals. You've got the Oculus Rift that's out and now the Google Cardboard and everybody's releasing these things. So in reality, we're already in it.
Uh-huh.
We just don't realize it.
How is your company Indio making a splash in this sphere and in other ways?
Well, Indio as a marketplace, as an online marketplace, where we're making our splash is that we're disrupting the way that films are bought and sold right now. So Right now, if you want your film sold, you have to go to like brick and mortar markets. There's like 7 major ones around the world. They can cost you anywhere from $10,000 to $15,000 to $50,000. Many people pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to just to travel there to get their exhibition booths and all that wonderful stuff. And then that doesn't guarantee that they'll even sell their film. So our platform is free to use. And what that does, and this isn't like an advertisement, but basically there's a lot of platforms that are starting to come out like ours, where it basically disrupts this idea that you actually have to like get up and travel across the world to sell your film. Now you can, with platforms like ours, you can just get online and sell it from in your pajamas.
That's a nice way to do it. Well, and as you look at that, this whole show has been about people disrupting traditional business models, by the way. It just worked out that way today. But as you continue to innovate, I still want to circle back just for a minute to Cannes. What are some of your biggest highlights from that experience? Any celebrity encounters? What? Tell me all about it.
Well, the biggest encounter that you get at Cannes is what I call the Cannes crud, which is the sickness that you get because you're literally engaging with about 20,000 people, and you're working day and night, and so your immune system's compromised, everything's compromised, and like 3 days in, you're just covered in snot. So that's my wonderful encounter.
Oh no!
You're welcome for the visual, guys. I'm more on the business side, so I don't really focus on. I don't really have a lot of run-ins with celebrities. Uh-huh. I did have the pleasure of going to 3 red carpets, which was really rare. So that was nice. A few selfies were taken. The biggest thing, the biggest thing is the relationships that were spawned out of that. Out of the whole visit.
It's a huge networking opportunity for you.
It's the best networking event. As a matter of fact, we have another partner of ours that goes out there with another company, and he used to hit all the other markets, and he's pretty much basically said, you know what, Cannes is so important that he's just going to cancel all other trips and dump all of his finances into just going and making his splash at Cannes the biggest.
Wow. And did you get to see some incredible films? How many screenings did you go to?
I went to 3 screenings. Now, they do have, like, screenings all the time, but we were really working. We have a pavilion at Cannes, so we have a physical presence at Cannes. We're always there. So I went to 3 films. Daniel Blake was the one that won the Palme d'Or or whatever. Not a very good film, I don't think, but it won, so there's that. The film that I really liked was a Korean film, I forget the name of it. So when
it was so good, you can't remember the name of it. Okay. So if virtual reality is transforming the movie business, and it is an incredibly profitable business still today, what else do you see happening when it comes to the film business?
My goodness, what a it's a, not in a bad way, but it's totally a loaded question.
Okay.
Because there's so much happening with the film business. The purchases are getting smaller, the budgets are getting smaller, and things are getting very specific. So like what you learn in them when you go to the markets is you're like, oh, I have this great idea for this film. I'm going to make this zombie movie. We're going to make it for cheap and everybody's going to love it because everybody loves zombie movies. And then you get to the market and nobody's buying zombie movies. They're buying buddy road trip movies with drugs and alcohol. They're buying family friendly Christmas films with talking dogs. Like they're very specific. Well, that used to be how you could play the field. But now it's to the point where they're like, we don't care what your movie is as long as it has 3 A-list names. You put 3 A-list names in the film and you're good. So what people are having to do is they're having to budget how can we get 3 A-list names? But now they're saying, okay, if these films cost more than $2 million, then we're not going to buy them. So what you're seeing is the price point of these films drop. And the demand for what's in the film get higher. So it's harder for independent filmmakers, but at the same time, it's also easier. And that's a whole other show in itself to talk about.
Maybe you'll come back and talk about that the next time.
I'd love to.
He's Dwight Cenac of the local film Indio, just back from the Cannes Film Festival. Fascinating to talk with you.
Oh, again, thank you so much.
Thanks for being here. Well, that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. You can subscribe to the daily podcast up every day at iTunes and Stitcher, or watch the show with video on demand segments at our partner tvjax.com, some segments at metrojacksonville.com. Next on Diane Rehm, attacking the media, a regular part of Donald Trump's campaign. This week, the presumptive GOP nominee lobbed insults at reporters and promised more of the same if he becomes president. A look at how Trump's rocky relationship with the press both helps and hinders his appeal. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.